Chapter 10. Mushkin understood at last why he turned cold every time he touched those three letters, and why he had put off reading them until the evening. When, in the morning, he had sunk into a heavy sleep on the lounge in the veranda, without having brought himself to open those three envelopes, he had another painful dream, and again the same sinful woman came to him. Again she looked at him with tears sparkling on her long eyelashes, again beckoned him to follow her, and again he waked up, as he had done before, with anguish recalling her face. He wanted to go to her at once, but could not. At last, almost in despair, he opened the letters and began reading them. These letters, too, were like a dream. Sometimes one dreams strange, impossible, and incredible dreams. On awakening, you remember them and are amazed at a strange fact. You remember, first of all, that your reason did not desert you throughout the dream. You remember even that you acted very cunningly and logically through all that long, long time, while you were surrounded by murderers who deceived you, hid their intentions, behaved amicably to you while they had a weapon in readiness, and were only waiting for some signal. You remember how cleverly you deceived them at last, hiding from them. Then you guessed that they'd seen through your deception and were only pretending not to know where you were hidden. But you were sly then, and deceived them again. All this you remember clearly. But how was it that you could at the same time reconcile your reason to the obvious absurdities and impossibilities with which your dream was overflowing? One of your murderers turned into a woman before your eyes, and the woman into a little sly, loathsome dwarf. And you accepted it all at once as an accomplished fact, almost without the slightest surprise, at the very time when, on another side, your reason was at its highest tension and showed extraordinary power, cunning, sagacity, and logic. And why, too, on waking up and fully returning to reality, do you feel almost every time, and sometimes with extraordinary intensity, that you have left something unexplained behind with the dream? You laugh at the absurdities of your dream, and at the same time you feel that, interwoven with those absurdities, some thought lies hidden, and a thought that is real, something belonging to your actual life, something that exists and has always existed in your heart. It's as though something new, prophetic, that you were awaiting, has been told you in your dream. Your impression is vivid, it may be joyful or agonizing, but what it is, and what was said to you, you cannot understand or recall. It was almost like this after reading these letters. But even before he had unfolded them, Mushkin felt that the very fact of the existence and the possibility of them was like a nightmare. How could she have brought herself to write to her? He asked himself as he wandered about alone that evening, at times not knowing where he was going. How could she write of that? How could such a mad fantasy have arisen in her mind? But that fantasy had by now taken shape, and the most amazing thing of all for him was that, as he read those letters, he himself almost believed in the possibility and the justification of that fantasy. Yet, of course, it was a dream, a nightmare, a madness. But there was something in it tormentingly real and agonizingly true, which justified the dream and the nightmare and the madness. For several hours together he seemed to be haunted by what he had read, every minute recalling fragments of it, brooding over them, pondering them. Sometimes he was even inclined to tell himself that he had foreseen all this and known it beforehand. It even seemed to him as though he had read it all before, some time very long ago, and that everything that he had grieved over since, everything that had been a pain or a dread to him, had all lain hidden in those letters he had read long ago.
"When you open this letter," so the first epistle began, "you will look first of all at the signature. The signature will tell you all, and explain all, so there's no need to make any defence or explanation. If I were in any way on a level with you, you might be offended at such impertinence. But who am I, and who are you? We are two such opposite extremes, and I am so infinitely below you that I cannot insult you, even if I wanted to."
In another place she wrote,
"Don't consider my words the sick ecstasy of a sick mind, but you are for me perfection. I have seen you. I see you every day. I don't judge you.
I have not come by reason to believe that you are perfection. I simply have faith in it. But one wrong I do you. I love you. Perfection should not be loved. One can only look on perfection as perfection. Is that not so? Yet I am in love with you. Though love makes equal, yet don't be uneasy. I have not put myself on an equality with you, even in my most secret thought. I have written, don't be uneasy. Can you possibly be uneasy? I would kiss your footprints if I could. Oh, I don't put myself on a level with you. Look at my signature. You need only look at my signature. I notice, however, she wrote in another letter, that I join your name with his, and I have never once asked myself whether you love him. He loved you, though he had seen you only once. He thought of you as of light. Those are his own words. I heard them from him. But without words, I knew that you were light for him. I have lived a whole month beside him, and understood then that you love him too. To me, you and he are one. What does this mean? She wrote again. Yesterday I passed by you, and you seemed to blush. It can't be so. It was my fancy. If you were brought to the filthiest den and shown vice in its nakedness, you should not blush. You are too lofty to resent an insult. You can hate everyone base and low, not for your own sake, but for the sake of others, those whom they wrong. You no one can wrong. Do you know I think you even ought to love me? You are for me the same as for him, a ray of light. An angel cannot hate, cannot help loving. Can one love everyone, all men, all one's neighbours? I have often asked myself that question. Of course not. It's unnatural indeed. In abstract love for humanity, one almost always loves no one but oneself. But that's impossible for us, and you are different. How could you not love anyone, when you cannot compare yourself with anyone, and when you are above every insult, every personal resentment? You alone can love without egoism. You alone can love, not for yourself, but for the sake of him whom you love. Oh, how bitter it would be for me to find out that you feel shame or anger on account of me. That would be your ruin. You would sink to my level at once. Yesterday, after meeting you, I went home and invented a picture. Artists always paint Christ as he appears in the gospel stories. I would paint him differently. I would imagine him alone. His disciples must have sometimes left him alone. I would leave only a little child beside him. The child would be playing beside him, perhaps be telling him something in his childish words. Christ has been listening, but now he is thoughtful, his hand still resting unconsciously on the child's fair little head. He is looking into the distance at the horizon. Thought, great as the whole world, dwells in his eyes. His face is sorrowful. The child leans silent with his elbow on Christ's knees, his cheek on his little hand and his head turned upwards, and looks intently at him, pondering as little children sometimes ponder. The sun is setting. That is my picture. You are innocent, and in your innocence lies all your perfection. Oh, only remember that. What have you to do with my passion for you? You are now altogether mine. I shall be all my life beside you. I shall soon die. Finally, in the very last letter stood the words, "For God's sake, think nothing of me, and don't think that I am abasing myself by writing to you like this, or that I belong to the class of people who enjoy abasing themselves, even if from pride. No, I have my consolation. But it is difficult for me to explain it to you. It would be difficult for me to explain it clearly even to myself, although it torments me that I cannot. But I know that I cannot abase myself, even from an excess of pride, and of self-abasement from purity of heart I am incapable. And so I do not abase myself at all. Why do I so want to bring you together? For your sake or for my own? For my own sake, of course. For myself, of course, it would solve all my difficulties. I have told myself so long ago.
I have heard that your sister Adelaida said of my portrait, then, that with such beauty one might turn the world upside down. But I have renounced the world. Does it amuse you to hear that from me, meeting me decked in lace and diamonds in the company of drunkards and profligates? Don't mind that. I have almost ceased to exist, and I know it. God knows what in my stead lives within me. I read that every day in two terrible eyes which are always gazing at me, even when they are not before me. Those eyes are silent now. They are always silent, but I know their secret. His house is gloomy, and there is a secret in it. I am sure that he has hidden in his box a razor wrapped in silk, like that murderer in Moscow. He too lived in the same house with his mother, and kept a razor wrapped in silk to cut a throat with. All the time I was in their house, I kept fancying that somewhere under the floor there might be a corpse hidden there, by his father, perhaps, wrapped in American leather, like the corpse in the Moscow case, and surrounded in the same way with jars of Zhdanov's fluid. I could show you the corner. He's always silent. But I know he loves me so much that he can't help hating me. Your marriage and ours are to take place together. We have fixed that. I have no secrets from him. I should kill him from terror, but he will kill me first. He laughed just now and said I was raving. He knows I am writing to you. And there was much, much more of the same kind of raving in those letters. One of them, the second, written in a small hand, covered two large sheets of notepaper. At last Mushkin came out of the darkness of the park, where he had been wandering a long time, as he had the previous night. The clear, limpid night seemed to him lighter than ever. "Can it still be so early?" he thought. He had forgotten to take his watch. He fancied he heard music somewhere in the distance. "It must be at the station," he thought. "They've certainly not gone there today." As he made the reflection, he saw that he was standing close to the Epanchins' villa. He knew quite well that he was bound to find himself there at last, and with a beating heart he went up to the steps of the veranda. No one met him. The veranda was empty. He waited and opened the door into the room. They never shut that door. The thought flickered through his mind, but the room was empty too. It was almost dark in it. He stood still in the middle of the room in perplexity. Suddenly the door opened, and Alexandra came in with a candle in her hand. On seeing Mushkin, she was surprised and stopped short before him inquiringly. Obviously, she was simply crossing the room from one door to the other, with no idea of finding anyone there.
"How do you come here?"
she asked at last.
"I came in."
"Maman is not quite well, nor Aglaia either. Adelaida is going to bed. I'm going too. We've been at home by ourselves all the evening. Papa and the prince are in Petersburg.
I've come to you now.
Do you know what the time is?"
"No."
"12:30.
We always go to bed by 1. "Why, I thought it was 9:30.
"It doesn't matter," she laughed. "And why didn't you come in before? We may have been expecting you."
"I thought..."
He faltered, moving away.
"Goodbye. Tomorrow I shall make them all laugh."
He went homewards by the road that encircled the park. His heart was beating, his thoughts were in a maze, and everything round him became like a dream. And suddenly, just as yesterday he had twice waked up at the same dream, the same apparition rose again before him. The same woman came out of the park and stood before him, as though she had been waiting for him there. He started and stood still. She snatched his hand and pressed it tight. No, this was not an apparition. And at last she stood before him, face to face for the first time since their parting. She was saying something to him, but he looked at her in silence. His heart was too full and ached with anguish. Oh, never could he forget that meeting with her, and he always remembered it with the same anguish. She sank on her knees before him on the spot, in the street, like one demented. He stepped back in horror, and she tried to catch his hand to kiss it, and just as in his dream that night, the tears glistened on her long eyelashes. "Stand up! Stand up!" he said in a frightened whisper, raising her. "Stand up at once!"
"Are you happy?" happy?" she asked. "Only say one word to me. Are you happy now, today, this minute? Have you been with her? What did she say?"
She did not get up. She did not hear him. She questioned him hurriedly, and was in haste to speak, as though she were being pursued.
"I'm going tomorrow, as you told me. I won't... It's the last time I shall see you. The last time. Now, it's absolutely the last time."
"Calm yourself. Stand up," he said in despair. She looked greedily at him, clutching at his hands.
"Goodbye,"
she said at last. She got up and went quickly away from him, almost running. Mushkin saw that Rogojin had suddenly appeared beside her, that he had taken her arm and was leading her away.
"Wait a minute, Prince," cried Rogojin. "I'll be back in 5 minutes."
5 minutes later he did in fact return. Mushkin was waiting for him at the same place.
"I've put her in the carriage," he said. "It's been waiting there at the corner since 10 o'clock. She knew you'd be at the young lady's all the evening. I told her exactly what you wrote to me today. She won't write to the young lady again, she's promised, and she'll go away from here tomorrow, as you wish. She wanted to see you for the last time, though you refused her. We've been waiting for you here, on that seat there, to catch you as you came back."
"Did she take you with her of her own accord?"
"Why not?" grinned Rogojin. "I saw what I knew before. You've read the letters, I suppose."
"Have you really read them?"
asked Mushkin, struck by that idea.
"Rather. She showed me each one of them herself. About the razor, too, do you remember?"
"She's mad," cried Mushkin, wringing his hands.
"Who knows about that?"
"Perhaps not," Rogojin said softly, as though to himself. Mushkin did not answer.
"Well, goodbye," said Rogojin. "I'm going away tomorrow, too. Don't remember evil against me. And I say, brother," he added, turning quickly, "why didn't you answer her question? Are you happy or not?"
"No. No, no,"
cried Mushkin with unspeakable sadness.
"I should think not indeed,"
laughed Rogojin maliciously as he went away without looking back.